Welcome to Signs of Life, exploring survival of consciousness, brought to you by the Forever Family Foundation on the web at www.foreverfamilyfoundation.org.
I can feel you like an ocean that won't seem to let me go.
Hello, good evening, and welcome to Signs of Life, brought to you by Forever Family Foundation with our host, Bob Ginsberg. I'm Fran Ginsberg, and our show tonight is sponsored by the Winbridge Institute for Applied Research in Human Potential, and that can be found on the web at www.winbridge.org. Tonight's guest is Steve Volk, and if you have a question, comment, or would like to talk to our guest, the toll-free number is 888-627-6008, or you can instant message the studio at Signs of Life Radio on AIM. And good evening to you, Bob.
And the same to you, Fran. I'd like to wish our listeners a happy and peaceful Mother's Day. I know to some it's a celebratory day, and we, of course, know that for others that may have moms on the other side, or possibly
moms who have children on the other side.
Moms who have children on the other side, you know, the day brings back a lot of memories, and sometimes it could be a little difficult to get through. But I guess people get through by different ways, you know, focusing on the good things. Diversions,
hiding,
you know.
A lot of people run away. They go to places where, like casinos, where there's no time and space, and they just kind of wait out the time for everything to pass. I mean, I'm sure the last place they want to be is in a restaurant with a bunch of people celebrating Mother's Day.
Well, and then for others, though, we know that everybody's different, and some might find comfort in that, you know, and make a celebration out of it. I know we were looking at the newspaper together, and we saw yesterday two well-known figures passed away.
Maurice Sendak,
the children's author. And
have the most famous book, Max, King of Where the Wild Things Are.
Yeah. And Vidal Sassoon, right?
Right.
So when we were talking
our younger listeners, they probably don't even know who Vidal Sassoon is, but he was the great hairstylist from the 60s who, you know, revolutionized the way you take care of your hair instead of sitting under dryers with blow dryers, and, you know, with hair dryers,
right,
and using the modern day handheld blow dryers, and he styled new hairstyles just for that.
Right. And you raised an interesting question to me. You know, when you have somebody, let's say like Maurice Sendak, who's, you know, a very famous author of children's books, and there's literally millions and millions of kids who grew up reading those books and having those books read to them. So do you think that
some
people,
of those kids are now on the other side.
Right. So do you think that spirit knows, you know, that they follow such things? Like they know that Maurice Sendak, you know, now is among them, and they look forward to greet them? Or do you think they have a different perspective?
I think there's a knowledge of what their relationship was to him or even with him when they were all in the physical world at the same time, and now that they're all on the other side at the same time, there's that inner knowledge that we had this relationship when we were in the physical, and that's a memory that stays with us all. And, you know, it's not like if they were groupie kids for Maurice Sendak that they're groupie kids over there. It's just a recognition, like a badge or a uniform that you might wear. It's like it goes with you.
Or it could be some sort of a link, you know, or a bond, you know, because it was part of their physical lives. Then you could also make the argument, well, they wouldn't be interested because, you know, now they're their soul, maybe an elevated soul or maybe soul of many parts, and that was just like one part. But I kind of agree with you. I would think that if it was very important to you while you were in the physical, that you might want to communicate, you know, with this or help, you know, this new soul that came to the other side.
And just speaking of Maurice Sendak and what he did in revolutionizing how children's books are written, I mean, up until his books hit the parenting segment, his original books were not well received because parents said, oh, he's talking about negative stuff. He's talking about, you know, spooks that hide under the bed and all these terrible things. But he was really writing the book more so from his own experience as a kid and being afraid to go to sleep at night because there was something in the room,
right,
or there was something under the bed. So I think that in and of itself is very interesting, knowing what we know now about kids who leave their rooms to go sleep with their parents because they do sense something in the room. And yet he was brave enough to write about it. And when the books caught on, a lot of, you know, new age parents said, yeah, this is something we want to read our kids because this is something we want to talk about. And, you know, Max wins out in the end at the book, and why not?
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah, it's an interesting, you know, concept. I mean, I think, well, I mean, let's say you're it could be in any field, but you know, I mean, I'm a big sports fan, you know. So let's say I'm on the other side, and somebody that I followed for most of my physical life, I mean, you could use anybody, but, you know, Mickey Mantle, you know, Panthers.
Right.
You know, so, if I retain my memories, which we think that you do, I would say, you know, well, I don't know exactly how you travel from one realm to the other, but some say there are different levels and different spheres and different vibrations and different resonance, and you can move down. And wherever I was, I'd be curious, you know, to talk to somebody that was my idol when I was growing up.
Well, here's the big old question that people ask a lot is, a lot of these well-known celebrities and famous people are on the other side, Frank Sinatra and all that, and we don't really hear from them. We don't really, really hear from them. And maybe it is just that. It's who they were here is more or less like a veterinarian wearing a veterinarian's jacket when he comes to examine your pet. And so when he's on the other side, if it's Frank Sinatra, he's wearing the recognizable aura of Frank Sinatra, but it's not the Frank Sinatra everybody has to chase around on the other side because he's a famous person. Just, oh, okay, that's who you were.
Right.
I recognize that energy, or I recognize that soul. It's cool that we're on the same enlightened level or something like that. And then when somebody who recognizes him can come through, they may mention, and we have heard that mentioned in certain medium readings, oh, so-and-so is here.
Yeah, and then also you can take that further. I mean, you know, Frank Sinatra, if you believe in, you know, many lives and reincarnation, you know, you talk about recognizing his particular aura, but he could have also been, you know, a peasant in India, you know, in another life, and that is a recognizable aura as well, I guess, you know.
Right, absolutely.
Yeah.
And he could have been Moses as one point.
Yeah.
So wouldn't that be cool once we get to the other side? We see an energy and we see all the different incarnations of that energy that we can actually recognize.
Yeah, sometimes I think it's difficult for somebody that was famous in this life to come through, because if they came through a medium, you know, they'd be criticized, or the medium would be criticized. Oh, sure, you're bringing through Frank Sinatra.
Absolutely,
you know.
And we've seen that. We've seen that with people who claim to channel the wise people, like Albert Einstein and
right.
Benjamin Franklin, and those people who did things here in the physical and really changed the way the world operates.
All right, well, we're going to go to a break. When we come back, we're going to have a fascinating guest. His name is Steve Volk. He's an author. He wrote a book called Fringeology. So stay with us, and when we come back, we'll learn more and speak to author Steve Volk.
When grieving the loss of a loved one, sometimes a hug is just what you need. Hugs from Heaven are lightly weighted shoulder wraps that are made from the fabric of your loved one's clothing. Your clothing can also be made into memory pillows and sachets. Each Hugs from Heaven is handmade with loving care and is as unique as your loved one's spirit. Visit us at hugsfromheaven.com. That's hugs, spelled with a Z, from heaven.com. Who couldn't use a hug?
For years, people have been reporting communication from those no longer in our physical world. Historically, science and religion have taught us to ignore such messages. Yet, there is now substantial scientific evidence to the contrary. In response to this, the Forever Family Foundation has developed a sign registry to demonstrate the existence of this other dimension. On our website, people can register signs that they, after passing, plan on communicating to a specific loved one. Upon the registrant's passing, the stored information can be verified by the recipient of these signs. Participants will be taking part not only in a grand scientific experiment, but in providing the greatest gift of all, the knowledge that we survive our physical death. For more information, contact the Forever Family Foundation at 631-425-7707, or you can find us on the web at foreverfamilyfoundation.org. Or to register a sign, go directly to thesignregistry.com.
It is with great pleasure that we announce the formation of the Wimbridge Institute for Applied Research in Human Potential. Dr. Julie Beischel, Director of Research at Wimbridge and one of the premier investigators in the field of mediumship research, reports that the team at Wimbridge will continue pursuing the many unanswered questions that remain in the field of afterlife science. Please go to www.windbridge.org to learn more about this groundbreaking research institute. That's www.windbridge.org.
I would like to introduce you to the Forever Family Foundation, a nonprofit organization whose mission is to provide support for families who have suffered the loss of a loved one. We believe in the continuity of the family, even though a member has left the physical world. We invite anyone who's trying to cope with the loss of a loved one to contact the Forever Family Foundation at 631-425-7707 or on the web at foreverfamilyfoundation.org.
The American Association of Electronic Voice Phenomena has always been international and concerned with more than just EVP. To better serve the public, the AAEVP is now Association Transcommunication, or ATRANSC. Their new website is atransc.org, and their motto is Objective Evidence of Survival. The directors believe people should know that death is not dying, and what we learn now applies to what we will learn hereafter.
Welcome back to Signs of Life, brought to you by the Forever Family Foundation.
In, our guest tonight is Steve Volk. Our sponsor is the Wimbridge Institute for Applied Research in Human Potential and can be found on the web at www.windbridge.org. Bob?
And author Steve Volk is a city journalist and a longtime staff writer and regular contributor to Philadelphia Magazine. He's received dozens of journalism awards. He's appeared on numerous radio and TV talk shows. His new book is called Fringeology, in which he chronicles his own personal ghost story, which we'll hear more about, and he takes us into his own investigations of many types of paranormal phenomena. His website is stevevolk.com, that's Steve, V-O-L-K.com, and he has a very interesting blog called The Generalist, and you can read his blog by visiting stevevolk.com. Welcome, Steve.
Hey, thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate this.
It's a pleasure. You wrote a wonderful book. So I guess a good place to start, I mean, my vision of city reporters is, you know, they're used to covering things like crime and politics, and
yep.
I think it's fair to say that not many have ventured out to write a that they can't see. So what is it that compelled Steve Volk to take this journey?
I'll tell you, it's thick-headedness, bullheadedness, I suppose. I, You know, actually, the passing of my mom, and that plays a pretty, you know, pivotal role in the book. What happened really was, as a kid, I grew up with a sort of family ghost story that I had some memories of myself. And because reporters aren't supposed to look into things like that, I'd set it aside for many years. And then my mom died. And what's interesting is, you know, you look at a ghost story or you look at a death in the family, and they raise the same issues, the big issues, the questions that keep us up at night. Who are we? Why are we here? Are we alone in the universe? What happens when we die? And so when my mom passed, I just thought, you know, I can't go on like this. I got to figure out best as I can what's happening here. And so I took on a sort of a new beat. Instead of covering, although I still do cover at times crime and politics, I thought I've got to also start covering what it means to be human. You know, I've got to start covering the existential questions. And so that was really kind of the genesis of the book.
Yeah. Did you get a few little smirks from some of your reporter colleagues, or were they?
Yeah, and that was a difficult part for me. I mean, there were times that I woke up late at night, and you know, once I'd signed a contract, thinking, "What have I done?" You know,
right.
What have I done? Because some of the people I really respected here in Philadelphia, where I'm a reporter, and it's a tough town. You know,
yeah.
Some of the people I really respected were looking at me. I call it the second head look. They would look at me like I'd suddenly sprouted a second head when they heard what I was writing
we
about.
We know that look.
And, you know, thankfully, I have to say I'm very happy that not only has writing this book not hurt me, it's really helped. I'm back at the magazine with a, you know, full-time position, and, you know, the arrangement is better even than it was before. So, you know, people shouldn't be afraid to dip their toes into these waters.
Yeah, and as you've been talking about some of the reactions that you received, I realized that in this book you met with a lot of people, scientists, medical doctors who are brave enough to talk about some of these things, and you got a little taste of what the scientists faced from their peers. If you think it's something that you faced that was difficult, you can imagine what some of the people that you interviewed faced. So.
Their livelihood is really, in a lot of cases, based on holding a materialist worldview, which, put in really crude metaphorical terms, essentially we're hamburger. As Jerry Coyne wrote in the USA Today a couple months ago, we are, quote, meat computers. That's the materialist take on things. And scientists, in many cases, are expected to uphold that view. And I think the book, in a lot of ways, cries, you know, foul on that. You know, that's not true. It's not who we are.
Right. Well, you know, just by the title of the book, I mean, the subtitle is How I Tried to Explain Away the Unexplainable. So reading, you know, and couldn't. So, you know, I don't know, were you different going into meeting with all these people and interviewing them than you were coming out?
Yeah, I think going in, I was really kind of desperate for answers of some kind, and I was expecting, in a lot of ways, to be disappointed, right? I was kind of going in expecting that the meat computer view was going to hold up really, really well. It's just, you know, I think that for all of us, no matter how spiritual we may consider ourselves, you know, we're used to living in this world where the desk is a desk, and that's all it is, and your hand never passes right through it, right? You know, that the material world is as we see it to be. But I found that there were holes in that, and maybe a few more than I had necessarily expected.
You had a very interesting, you made a very interesting point in the book, Fringeology, when you said, you question whether the placebo effect should be considered to be paranormal, and when I read that, it made a lot of sense. I mean, we tend to not to believe as a society things that we can't see, so therefore we label them paranormal, but doctors recognize the placebo effect, but they would never consider that to be paranormal. So, I mean,
yeah, I think that ultimately the paranormal becomes a junk pile where people who are materialists in nature, who want to sort of cleave to a kind of, you know, atheistic sort of worldview, toss everything that's threatening to that position into, you know, that dustbin of the paranormal. And so they would never think to call the placebo effect necessarily. And that's when people get a dummy drug, but it does the work of a real drug, right? Mm. So you get saline, but you get the same effect as aspirin. How is that possible?
Right.
They don't think, I believe, to put a phenomenon like that under the umbrella of paranormal because it's not threatening to them. It doesn't seem to speak directly to the idea of there is a God or there is an afterlife. But something like, you know, ghosts or near-death experiences does speak directly to the possibility of an afterlife. And so they have to sort of shout it down. And one way of doing that is just slapping it with the stigma associated with the word paranormal. So one of the cases I try and make early in the book is if you look at the dictionary definition of the word, you know, there's always several definitions listed, but the one that I find most useful is something that exists beyond the range of current scientific explanation. And when you look at that way of explaining it, well, dark matter, you know, the origins of the universe, the placebo effect, most pharmaceuticals, for that matter, where we can't isolate necessarily the active ingredient or why it does what it does, all these things suddenly are paranormal. And I felt like it was useful to make that point to try and destigmatize the word.
Absolutely. You know, you probably weren't aware, for instance, when you started to investigate and talk to the Psi researchers, that were you surprised to learn about just how abundant the data was from, like, the PEAR Lab and people like Dean Radin and so forth? It's not something that's a year or two and a couple of studies. I mean, it's a decade of thousands of experiments. I mean, did that surprise you?
Yeah, Bob, I was stunned and scared.
Yeah.
It was when I said that there were sort of more cracks in the materialist worldview than I knew. That was one of the largest ones. It was one of the ones I didn't really expect, and it was one of the ones that kept me up awake at night because as a reporter, I've really sort of, you know, it's kind of a personal oath. It's not like we gather anywhere and take an oath to be a journalist. But, you know, over the years, 15 years doing this, I had certainly sworn an oath to myself to report the facts as I found them as accurately as I could and just sort of let people's reactions be whatever they're going to be. Well, here was a case where I started looking at the research into telepathy and, you know, what they call psi phenomenon, and found that it was much more abundant than I thought and pretty rigorously well-controlled in terms of the kind of experiments they do. And I would wake up sometimes at night and think, wow, I'm going to have to write, you know, that there is real reason to believe. It's not an irrational belief to hold that telepathy is real. And even now, you know, I feel a little tremor of like, wow, you know, I wonder how my editor will feel when he finds out I said that.
Well, you certainly have the data now to back it up. I mean, some of these things, as you read, you know, are the odds against chance in the millions to one. So it's not a coincidence.
It's not a coincidence. And I think what you find with that field, maybe more than any other, it's very, very hard to come up with any sort of controlled experiment to deal with something like the afterlife, right? But it's relatively easy in comparison, and I don't want to overstate that because there are great difficulties to doing a well-controlled test for mental telepathy, but certainly it's easier. You know, you sit on one side of the desk, I sit on the other. You have four cards of with varying symbols on them, and you shuffle them, and I'm supposed to name which one the next one is. I have a 1 in 4 chance of being right. That's 25%, right?
Right.
And if we do enough trials of that to achieve a real statistical sort of significance, if we do it 1,000 times and I check in being right 30% of the time instead of 25, well, we're on to something. Something seems to be happening here. That's a really straightforward kind of experiment that people can do, and you know, there have been variations of that with Zener cards.
Right.
And so I think what you find is that is one of the most threatening fields of the paranormal and parapsychology to sort of the skeptical class, because there it is right in front of you. The numbers don't lie, and yet they've worked really, really hard, the skeptics have, to find ways to deny those results.
Yeah, I mean, when you look at these things and you investigate, you know, telepathy and remote viewing and, you know, psychic communication, do you think it's a mistake to label them as spiritual endeavors? I mean, some people automatically put it into the spiritual realm. It may be just that's the way it is, you know.
You know, right. A really interesting fact about that, and I cover this in the book, and this is one of the most fascinating parts to me, is I surveyed the people at the Parapsychology Association's annual get-together, and it was in Seattle the year that I went. And it turned out that the majority of the people who responded to my survey, these are practicing parapsychologists, were themselves, they leaned toward atheist. They professed no religious or spiritual belief. They professed no sense of a connection between the existence of telepathy and the existence, let's say, of an afterlife. And so the people who tend to be doing this research aren't committed to, you know, a sort of a spiritual worldview. Some of them are, but the majority aren't. And that's what even makes it more interesting to me that the skeptics, like, instead of just sort of taking their tip from the parapsychologists themselves and saying, well, like, even these guys who believe in it don't think that it necessitates an afterlife, for instance, and going from there, they themselves are so sort of frightened by the idea that one mind might be able to read another at a distance, or one mind might be able to remote view an area at a distance, that you know, they try with all their might to shoot it down.
Yeah, because the next logical step, I mean, if you believe that, you know, the mind can act independently of the brain, then it all of a sudden it's not totally illogical to believe that we can survive our physical death.
And I will say that I think that my own sense of things, just sort of in a sociological way, is that parapsychologists faced such stigma over the years that I think that they have probably worked pretty hard to find some way of trying to appeal non-threatening to the sort of the mainstream researchers who aren't, you know, studying psi. And I certainly hate to sound like I'm demeaning this in this way, but I do feel that the position that they've taken, which is that, you know, this doesn't necessitate an afterlife, this doesn't necessitate spirituality, is in part a position of convenience. I think it's logically true. I don't think it does necessitate it, but it certainly makes it a lot more likely, right? It certainly starts to explain how one might be possible, right?
Yeah.
And I think that in order to sort of stay afloat in academia, there are probably times that they, you know, they just sort of get used to responding no on the questionnaire to do you believe in God.
Yeah, and I think also, you know, we can look at the abundance, you know, of data, and we can read research papers and hear anecdotal, you know, stories, but ultimately it's personal experience that really, you know, gets somebody to move from you know, to maybe hoping, to believing, to knowing. You know, I respect what I read you were doing in the book. I mean, you weren't just interviewing people; you were taking part. I mean, you went to a lucid dreaming, you know, workshop. You know, you went to, you know, mediums. You did a whole bunch of things. And would you agree that it's only personal experience that could really make a difference in as far as believing some of these things that you were studying?
And certainly, to a great extent, that's true. I think with something like psi phenomenon, the research is rigorous enough that whether you feel you've experienced telepathy or not, you should be able to look at that data that's accumulated and at least, you know, feel your mind open to the possibility. But I think in most areas, you're exactly right. I find most of the ghost shows on television to be so unbelievable that if I didn't have that kind of story in my own background, I would never linger over them for a second. But having gone out into some, you know, haunted houses, finding that, you know, plus the experience in my childhood, finding that, you know, the vast majority of them we were able to explain what was going on. But sometimes when I went on these ghost hunts, we didn't. And that's what really opened your mind, yeah.
Yeah. You told a fascinating story of what happened in Stephenville, Texas, and I was totally unaware of that, and I'm sure that 99% of the people that I would speak to don't, you know, wouldn't know. And it's not something that we talk about a lot, you know, in UFOs. But I noticed so many parallels, you know, when, you know, you started interviewing some of the witnesses. But can you just give us a quick overview of what happened there?
Well, yeah, dozens of people had the great misfortune of looking up, right, on an evening in January 2008. And I say the great misfortune because, you know, once they did, they saw something in the sky that they'd never seen before and they couldn't explain. And the majority of the people described it as a sort of white lights that moved with such an ease that they seemed to be part of one craft, but they were one craft. They were it was an impossibly huge size. One witness described it as being as big as a Walmart. It moved silently. It was capable of hearing, and it was capable of moving at speeds that outstripped the fighter jets that were seen in a chase position following it by a trio of witnesses. So, really a special sort of sighting, a sighting that to this day remains unexplained, a sighting that was corroborated by our evidence. The Mutual UFO Network, as MUFON, did a really great job in terms of a fast response. They immediately filed a Freedom of Information Act requests, which is a journalist tool, so I really admire that they knew it, did it. Call it FOIA, the reports from the local radar towers, and they found that there was an object in the sky with no trail under, meaning it was prepared to report into any traffic towers anywhere, as air traffic is supposed to be. And, it was there, and it traveled at speeds from stationary to usually around 40 or 50 miles an hour, which, you know, this is not a small airplane, and went to speed over 500 miles an hour. So really a special, special sighting. And the people there felt the stigma of having seen it. And I landed in Stephenville and started introducing myself around. The people were certainly always polite, but a lot of them were really disturbed that a reporter was there a little over a year later when they thought this was drifting in the world, drifting out of air. Their daily life, right? That a reporter was there to start asking questions about it again.
Yeah, I'm sure. We're having a little problem with the line, and it's time for a break. So we're going to go to a break. When we come back, we're going to talk more with author Steve Volk, and we're going to learn a little bit more also about this experience and the interviews that he had with the people in Stephenville. So stay with us, and we'll be back in a few.
Imagine seeing spirits are spontaneously speaking indigenous Brazilian rainforest languages. Janet Mayer, a psychic medium, does just that. In her new book, Spirits, They Are Present, she opens the door to her private life in order to share her compelling, fearful, and at times humorous journey, providing evidence that when we die, we simply make a transition to another life. Spirits, They Are Present, available now at www.janetmayer.net, Amazon, and other online booksellers. Order your copy today.
It is with great pleasure that we announce the formation of the Wimbridge Institute for Applied Research in Human Potential. Dr. Julie Beischel, Director of Research at Wimbridge and one of the premier investigators in the field of mediumship research, reports that the team at Wimbridge will continue pursuing the many unanswered questions that remain in the field of afterlife science. Please go to www.windbridge.org to learn more about this groundbreaking research institute. That's www.windbridge.org.
I would like to introduce you to the Forever Family Foundation, a nonprofit organization whose mission is to provide support for families who have suffered the loss of a loved one. We believe in the continuity of the family, even though a member has left the physical world. We invite anyone who's trying to cope with the loss of a loved one to contact the Forever Family Foundation at 631-425-7707 or on the web at foreverfamilyfoundation.org.
The Camlack Center is putting birth and death back together again. Aimed at changing the way we look at death, the Camlack Center was founded in 2002 as a publishing company and teaching center. When we know that there is nothing but life, we realize that birth and death are events in time and space. Our grief can open us to other dimensions of reality and allow us to experience our loved ones who are no longer in the physical body. Our events and products are based on personal experiences of survival of consciousness after physical death and decades of research into how death has influenced the development of our consciousness. Visit www.camlack.com, that's K-A-M-L-A-K.com, for articles, videos, books, and more to help you cope with the loss of a loved one.
For years, people have been reporting communication from those no longer in our physical world. Historically, science and religion have taught us to ignore such messages. Yet, there is now substantial scientific evidence to the contrary. In response to this, the Forever Family Foundation has developed a sign registry to demonstrate the existence of this other dimension. On our website, people can register signs that they, after passing, plan on communicating to a specific loved one. Upon the registrant's passing, the stored information can be verified by the recipient of these signs. Participants will be taking part not only in a grand scientific experiment, but in providing the greatest gift of all, the knowledge that we survive our physical death. For more information, contact the Forever Family Foundation at 631-425-7707, or you can find us on the web at foreverfamilyfoundation.org. Or to register a sign, go directly to thesignregistry.com.
Welcome back to Signs of Life, brought to you by the Forever Family Foundation.
You are just tuning in. Our guest tonight is Steve Volk. This show is sponsored by the Winbridge Institute for Applied Research in Human Potential and can be found on the web at www.winbridge.org. We want to take a moment now and recognize our 2011 benefactors. We thank them on behalf of the members of Forever Family Foundation who continue to benefit from their financial support. That's the Samadhi Research Institute, the Life After Life Club, and two anonymous donors, Kathleen Murray and Arthur Perkins, and Arlene and Frank McGonigal. We thank you for your support this past year. If you are a business interested in advertising on our show, please contact us at radio@foreverfamilyfoundation.org or call the office at 631-425-7707. We have a few important foundation updates for our listeners. We're sending out a big thank you to our supportive listeners who've made possible this past year of bringing you Signs of Life Radio. They know that even though we are a 100% volunteer, not-for-profit organization, it still takes a lot of money to do the work we do. And yet, we know that not everyone has extra income they can send along to support the continuation of our programming. So this is how easy it is to keep this radio show alive without sending us money. Go to foreverfamilyfoundation.org and apply for the Visa credit card. Visa will make a donation to us for each card that is taken out, and each time the card is used, a portion of that charge is donated back to Forever Family Foundation. Then, if your shopping takes you to the Internet, consider shopping at Amazon.com, but first use the link on the Forever Family Foundation website, and again, a portion of your spending comes back to support our work. Now, if you don't see what you want on Amazon, then sign up with iGive.com and name Forever Family Foundation as the charity of your choice. Then search iGive.com for your items. For each search, we receive a donation. And when you find what you are looking for, and there are more than 900 online stores very familiar to you, like Petco, Priceline, Sirius Radio, Snapfish, a portion of what you spend is again donated back to Forever Family Foundation. So please take a few moments when you shop to show us that you care. Dessert and Discarnates with certified medium Lynn LeClaire, and only 12 seats for our attendees. This exclusive fundraiser on June 22nd is full, and we thank Lynn. For those seeking a private reading with Lynn, she can be reached via her website at lynnthespiritualmedium.com. Another Dessert and Discarnates with certified medium Angelina Diana, same, only 12 seats for attendees at this exclusive fundraiser, is set for Oceanside, New York on August 10th, 2012. Go to the event page at foreverfamilyfoundation.org and click on the link for this event to reserve one of the 10 remaining seats. How to Listen When Your Children Speak, an afternoon workshop for parents who have lost children, 2 to 6 p.m. in Bethel, Connecticut, with certified medium Angelina Diana, opening to bring through only 10 children in spirit. The afternoon will include evidence of an afterlife from a parent's perspective and a refreshment break with conversations from other parents who have walked in those same shoes. Our annual November conference is set for Phoenix, Arizona, at the beautiful Hilton Phoenix Airport Hotel, with free shuttle service to and from the airport as well as to local attractions. And this conference will be the first of its kind as an intensive interactive weekend. Make your arrangements and reservations now as the hotel block is filling up. The weekend will begin with our annual Friday night fundraiser on November 9th, featuring Long Island medium Teresa Caputo, and will continue through November 10th and 11th with a select group of esteemed scientists answering your deepest questions about the reality of the spirit world. The weekend will also feature certified mediums Dave Campbell and Deborah Martin, joining our panel of presenters, Dr. Evan Alexander III, Lloyd Auerbach, Dr. Julie Beischel, Dr. Stafford Betty, and Dr. Claude Swanson. I'm done, Bob.
We are talking with Steve Volk. His website is stevevolk.com, and the book is called Fringeology, How I Tried to Explain Away the Unexplainable and Couldn't. Thanks for staying with us, Steve. And I know when we last left, you were mentioning this extraordinary sighting of a UFO in Stephensville, Texas. And I was really interested in the way you described, questioning the people and the fear and apprehension that you encountered. So is that something that you expected?
Well, to some extent, yes, because, I think that having just even been through what I've been through here in Philadelphia, telling colleagues I was going to write a book about the paranormal and seeing the looks I got, I could imagine that these people were dealing with problems, too. And it turned out that they were. The UFO sighting had sort of, and to some degree, it had split the town between people who saw it, people who didn't see it and didn't believe it, and people who didn't see it but knew, the people who had their back, right? And
right.
It really thrust a small town like Stephensville into a kind of crisis, because these are people who really know each other, and they seek first and foremost, it seems to me, to be good neighbors. And so a lot of the chapter dealing with Stephensville, it covers their attempt to hang together and to stay together.
Yeah, it certainly was a story within a story, but yeah, I wasn't surprised. I mean, we know that like people we encounter every day that have these so-called afterlife encounters and also simple psychic experiences, they're afraid to be labeled crazy. They don't tell their friends. They don't tell their family. Sometimes they don't tell their spouses, and they keep this secret within them. And I could just imagine, especially in that area of the country, that you were taken aback a little bit about and trying to walk in their shoes and to try to feel what they were experiencing.
I have to say, a big mission for me with this book, and when I've done public speaking engagements, this is something I really emphasize, is to try and remove that stigma, right? Remove the stigma from the word paranormal. get people comfortable with the idea of telling their stories. Because I think that if everyone really did come forward to talk about the strange thing, the unexplainable thing that happened to them, it would be a real deluge.
Yeah.
a real deluge of stories. And certainly I've experienced that in my own talks. I mean, people come up to me afterward. Can I tell you one of my favorite stories?
Sure.
Yeah. One of my favorite stories involved a hospice worker who came up to me and was telling me, because I'd told the story of Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, the psychologist who wrote on death and dying, and she had covered near-death experiences and what she called deathbed visitations, in which people who are terminally ill see deceased loved ones at their bedside or see some glimpse of what's to come, but they're still lucid enough to communicate with the people around them. And so I mentioned this, and the woman and I ended up having a conversation about it, and she told me that it happened to her quite frequently as a hospice professional. She'd had, you know, several events with different patients where this went on. And with one older gentleman, she was so comfortable with him. You know, what she'd usually do is when she could tell that's what was happening is she let people have the experience, and she would just sort of observe. She would just sort of check and make sure they were lucid and they were okay, and then she would let whatever was happening wind on. But this one old man, she was so close to him that she couldn't help herself, and she said to him, "Tell me what you're seeing." And he turned to her, completely lucid, and said, "Honey, I could tell you, but you'd never believe me."
And
isn't that great?
Yeah, it is, and what you said before is also true, that if people, it's common knowledge in hospice settings and in crisis, you know, facilities among mental health professionals that these things happen on a regular basis. I mean, it's no question.
Yeah.
They see deathbed visions every day, and yet I often call it like a dirty little secret. You know, it's so prevalent, but nobody wants to talk about it. But you can't change worldview if nobody talks about it. So,
And we've got to work on that. We really
yeah.
do. We have to work on that. And I think that part of the issue is that if we tell the story and don't stress the interpretation, right, just share the story. That's enough.
Right.
It'll generate some momentum. I think as soon as we start getting into, well, does that conform with anybody's, you know, religious views? How would that be possible from a materialist paradigm that, you know, this could happen? I think for the moment, we just need to focus on getting the stories out there.
I think you're right. You know, we talked a little bit about, you know, as a child, there was this family ghost, and I thought it was interesting that, you know, your parents evidently were not, you know, overly religious, you know, but they did what they thought was logical to do, and they went to a priest, you know, I mean, why do you suppose that strange happenings are interpreted by so many as having something to do with God?
Well, I mean, I think that we're raised, generally speaking, if we're raised in any sort of church, to think that that is the conduit, really, you know, and or portal through which the things we can't explain, right, the great mysteries,
right,
will arrive. And, you know, the priest is the one who was up there every Sunday talking to us about the things unseen. And so when something unseen seemed to be banging around in my house when I was around 5 or 6 years old, I was the youngest of 5 kids, and this went on for many, many months on a regular basis, and my parents looked for the logical explanations. They looked for the seen explanations, right? They looked for evidence that it was a plumbing problem, perhaps a water hammer. But the sound was so big and loud, and it went on for so long when it happened, that didn't comport with any plumbing problems they were aware of. You know, when they looked at all these explanations and none of them worked, well, who do you turn to, right?
Right.
There were no Ghostbusters in those days in the mid-70s. You went to your family priest.
That's true. And you know, now, especially you know, with what you learned, I mean, I know you're aware that a lot of researchers will attribute some of these goings-on, you know, these poltergeist activities, you know, to psychokinesis and you know, they're from living agents. But, you know, some scientists also reason that, you know, if our consciousness does survive our physical death, that it's very likely that as a discarnate entity we could also exhibit, you know, PK, you know, psychokinesis. So it's hard to tell what's going on, isn't it?
It is, and I tend to try and hold to the view that it's very possible that all the given explanations that have been put forward over the years could be true in some instances, right?
Mm.
So some of these very naturalistic explanations that are a little more exotic about an abundance of electromagnetic energy potentially even causing things to move, they might in some instances be true, right? But in our case, you know, and in many cases I've heard of and a couple things I ran across when I was out doing some ghost hunting, whatever it was seems to have a kind of intelligence that was independent of mine and the other people in the house, right? And that would seem to indicate, as you put it, you know, the discarnate entity.
Yeah, and I would, unfortunately, we won't have time to get into to many of the things that you wrote about, and people are just going to have to buy the book. But I would encourage people to do that. I know you interviewed a fascinating interview with Edgar Mitchell, and people should read the book to learn what the overview effect is. You spent some time in a lucid dreaming workshop with Stephen LaBerge. You interviewed Dr. Andrew Newberg, who does fascinating studies with the brain and how it relates to spirituality. You spent some time with Alan Botkin, and you sat for one of his IADC, induced after-death communication procedures, and
yeah,
and you reached.
Me the stick.
Yeah,
he gave me the stick, as his patients say. Yeah,
right. So I mean, you're not somebody that just sat there and took notes. I mean, you dove right into it. It makes for some fascinating reading. And again, the book is called Fringeology: How I Tried to Explain Away the Unexplainable and Couldn't. The website is Steve Volk, just the way it sounds, StevVolk.com. There's a lot of information on the site as well as a blog called The Generalist. Steve, thanks so much. I know we just didn't have enough time. I hope you'll come back and join us real soon so we can pick this conversation up.
I would be happy to come back, and the Forever Family Foundation in particular, I'd be very honored to come back.
Thank you very much. Have a good evening.
Thank you.
All right, take care.
We now ask our listeners to please join us in our Healing Energy Circle prayer. May the universe create a channel of healing energy from our participating listeners, sending that energy to those who are in need of recovery of the physical body, spirit, and mind as we visualize the healing light upon Vicki Steffi, Wendy Lippo, Mark Varon, Eileen Lafada, Joanne Gerber, Lynn LeClaire, CJ, Rita Springer, David Haith, Pat Longo, Barbara Petillo, Doreen Malloy, Glenna Irwin, Elizabeth McKenna, Chase McKenna, Julie B., and Stanley Mullen, and anybody else needing healing. Now let's give energy of love and gratitude to the waters and all the living creatures by praying like this. To the waters, whales, dolphins, pelicans, fishes, shellfishes, planktons, coral, algae, and all creatures in our Earth's waters, I apologize. Please forgive me. Thank you. I love you. Taken from the original Gulf Water Prayer by Masaru Emoto back on May 9th, 2010. And now it's time to say,
our loved ones are only a heartbeat away.
And science is going to prove it.
Good night, everyone.